All right. So, as always, let me start by asking if you have questions from what we did last week. Questions about, I think, Iceland, if I remember correctly, was last week. Any questions about Somali? All right. No questions about Somali. So I guess we can go home, right? Let's see. To begin with, let me say a little bit about the sources of information that I'm using for that chapter. Both of them deal with northern Somalia. And it's pretty clear reading Lewis, who is the much more detailed one, that there are significant differences between north and south. Some of them maybe because the north was under British rule of some sort. I don't know what it was called, not a colony, but protectorate or something, and the south Italian. But also it sounds as though there are significant differences because the north is mostly cattle herders, mostly nomadic, whereas the south is a good deal more agriculture. And the picture actually one gets, which I don't really reflect much in the chapter, but reading Lewis's stuff of the northern culture is sort of interesting because it's one where you've got, if I've got it correctly, the women and the children staying at a fixed location, and maybe the older adult men, I'm not sure, but the young men and teenage boys are wandering around with their herds of camels, and I gather the situation with regard to forage is such that you can't stay still because you eat up the food, and so they're going from sort of one source of water to another and grazing around, and then I think maybe coming back maybe in the winter. I don't remember. It's been a while since I read that description, but it was sort of an interesting picture of a lifestyle very different from anything that we're used to. At the same time, it was clearly a society where people were used to violence, and the impression was that wasn't limited to Somalia, that it was true of the Horn of Africa in general. I may have quoted Lewis's line that in the Horn of Africa, every adult male has an AK-47, which is a Russian-made assault rifle. Probably a slight exaggeration, but I think probably not very much. As far as I can tell, nobody really knows how much actual violence occurred in the traditional system. That what we're mostly hearing stories about is really a system that's been broken down in various ways and has reformed or not reformed to different degrees in different places. The situation, as far as I can tell at present, is that most of what was the British area has turned itself into the Republic of Somaliland, which nobody else will recognize. That the northeastern corner, which is called Puntland, regards itself as a semi-independent province of the state of Somalia. That is to say, unlike Somaliland, they don't think of themselves as independent, but they don't actually take orders from anybody. I think that's where most of the piracy is coming from, as far as I can tell. And then the southern chunk of it is where all the news stories you hear are happening. That's where Mogadishu is, and that's where from time to time somebody tries to set up a government and then somebody else smashes it, essentially. In any case, my first source that I read, actually this started with a paper a student did, I think a couple of years ago, and her father, I think, had actually done a film on Somalia, and she was using some of the information he had gotten and wrote an interesting paper. And then I went to her source, which was Van Noten's book, and which was interesting because he'd actually seen it firsthand. On the other hand, he didn't finish the book. He died before it was finished. It was edited by somebody who has political views similar to mine and therefore can't be trusted, or at least can't be trusted for me to fairly evaluate him. And Van Noten himself clearly had somewhat similar views, so that parts of the Van Noten book really are what can the modern world learn from the better Somali way of doing things, as it were, which is lots of fun. But then I started looking for more information, and I think that was the quarter when I was visiting at George Mason, because George Mason has a bunch of interesting, odd, sort of younger economists who I wanted to interact with, and I thought it would be fun to go spend a quarter interacting with, and it was fun. It's a sort of bunch of people where you've got a building where every noon, like half the faculty go out to lunch together and argue about things and talk about things and such. And that was fun. I liked that. But anyway, I went to the library at George Mason and went looking for stuff about Somalia. And I think, as I remember, like the first book I found was by I.M. Lewis, and the second book I found was by I.M. Lewis, and the third book I found was by I.M. Lewis, and the fourth book I found was a festschrift in honor of I.M. Lewis. So I figured I had found my source. And I read what I could find then, and it was clear that he was an anthropologist whose specialty had really been Somalia, and especially northern Somalia. That is, he does say some stuff about the southern, that he had gotten interested in it, I think, as a graduate student in the 1950s, so he's a fairly old man now, retired, and had been keeping in touch and doing some writing about it ever since. But what he's basically interested in, he certainly has views about the present situation. He is not an admirer of the UN or the UN's role in Somalia. But what he's really interested in was the traditional system. At the time when he studied it, Somaliland was British Somaliland. But from his description, it sounds as though the British were ruling with a pretty light hand, and for most practical purposes, it was really the traditional institutions that were controlling things. I think I may have mentioned earlier one of the, I thought, interesting bits being the ways in which the Somalis gamed the British, that is, in which the Somalis tried to take advantage of the existence of the British in order to help them succeed in their internal interactions. I think I mentioned before the pattern of you're about to attack some people, so you send word to the British that there's going to be violence, and you make sure that the word reaches them late enough so they won't show up until after your attack, but can then hope with luck stop the counterattack, which I thought was sort of interesting. In general, sort of a lot of what I find interesting in all of these things is taking the people seriously. That is, realizing that they aren't puppets, they aren't children, they are themselves adults who are just as much players as we are, as it were, when we happen to be interacting, and can't be expected to rearrange things according to our prejudices. The impression that one gets from both Van Noten and Lewis is that the traditional Somali system worked tolerably well, whereas what replaced it did not. And what replaced it was initially a democratic single government set up by the British and the Italians on their way out, as it were. That only lasted for 9 years and was then followed by a military coup, and the military coup put in a military dictator by the name of Bari. And the impression one gets from the bits and pieces I've read was that he was not a very nice person and was sort of trying to reconstruct things along his preferred lines without a lot of success, and trying to break down the traditional system without a lot of success. I seem to remember that one of his rules was that you weren't supposed to include the name of your clan in your name or in your identification or something. And eventually he gets into a war with Ethiopia. As I think I may have mentioned before, the Soviets, who had been backing Bari, decide for some reason to back the Ethiopians instead, which means the Ethiopians have a better source of armaments than the Somali, and the Somali do pretty badly, and Bari is overthrown, and at that point things are sliding back towards more or less their normal equilibrium, except that there's an attempt to reestablish a central government in Mogadishu being pushed by the U.S., the U.N., and the Ethiopians. And that seems to be the basis of the situation. But now, whether we would admire the traditional system is hard to tell. As I said, we don't know how many people were or weren't getting killed in the 1950s, say, only that there was a functional system. And my initial inclination was to contrast it to the Icelandic system, because it's pretty clear that the Somali system really is a feud system. And Iceland I'd studied in the past and thought I more or less understood. And it's an interesting contrast. On the one hand, they're both feud systems. Neither of them has any government law enforcement or anything you can recognize as government law enforcement. In both of them, the sort of normal lawful outcome is that if you've wronged somebody, you owe a fine to him or to his kin if he's dead. In both of them, what ultimately enforces that outcome is private violence on behalf of those who think they've been wronged. So in that sense, they are similar systems, but they're different in a whole lot of the details. that Iceland has an explicit law code, memorized and eventually written, a legislature which has got the power to change the law code, a hierarchical structure of courts, and all of that goes into authorizing the use of force, although the force that's being authorized is private force. There's nobody backing up that authorization except other private people. The Somali case, in contrast, there is nobody who can say, this is the law, you know, starting here and I'll recite the whole thing. But there are lots of people who think they know what the law is, so that the law is a traditional legal system. And if they, yeah?
I was wondering, during those times when you had the dictator and
Bari, yeah?
Previous interventions and so forth, to what degree did that destroy the tradition?
Yeah. That is, my impression is that it was not at all true with the British. I don't know enough about the Italian end of southern Somalia. The impression I get is that things largely survived, but that Bari was trying to destroy a good deal of it, but it doesn't sound as though he was very successful. But I really don't know. I think I do have some of the relevant books are on reserve, and if anybody's sufficiently interested, I've got the one that I thought was the best one, which is really one of the early ones, at home, and could lend it to somebody to look at. I think that's one we didn't have, as I remember, but that I eventually found online, which is you can do nowadays much more easily than you used to be able to find books. So the Somali case, you've got a customary law. It's combined in some areas with Islamic law, that the Somali are almost all Muslims. And I don't know if that was a source of conflict with Ethiopia, which was a Christian very early on. Certain areas, such as marriage and inheritance, are largely Muslim law. And the rules associated with damage payments for death or injury are not identical to the rules of Islamic law, but pretty clearly are based on them because it's a very fairly close parallelism. So both systems, the damage payment for killing somebody is measured in camels, although the formula for measuring it isn't the same. I think in both systems, if you cripple one arm, that's like half a life, and so forth. Although, as I think, again, not all of the details are the same. A similarity between the Somali and the Islamic, but not the Icelandic, is the decentralized nature of lawmaking. That is to say that in the Islamic, it's really a matter of the mufti tells you what he thinks the legal scholars have decided the law is, believed to come originally from religious sources. The Somali, as far as I can tell, except for the parts that are Islamic law, don't see it as having a religious basis. It's rather, this is the tradition of our people, this is how it ought to be done, this is the right way of doing it. But again, it's a decentralized process in which, in various contexts, you choose a judge who's really an arbitrator, not a professional, and the judge gives a verdict. And if people don't like the verdict, then they probably don't choose that guy to be judge again. And if people do like the verdict, then the next judge over says, yes, I heard that such and such was a good decision in a very similar case. So it's not as organized as our case, as our precedent case law system, but it's got a sort of an informal similarity to that, from at least the description we're getting. A lot of that is from Van Noten, who was sort of looking at it on the ground. And you've got this explicit. What did you say?
No. So then, after the original decision is rendered by the arbitrator, and there's room for appeal, right? And then the select an arbiter for each community.
And it sounds as though the range of judges is expanding when you go to the appeal. As if I understand the situation correctly, and I'm not sure I do, in the first round you have a court which is agreed on by the two parties from their elders. But notice that this is all a little tricky, because one of the things that sort of is confusing about the system is that it's not as if there is a single unit I'm part of. I'm part of a whole nested Chinese box of units. So that at one level, my unit is something like the descendants of a common great-grandfather. But then I'm also part of the descendants of a common great-great-grandfather, and so far up. So if you get all the way up to the clan, I believe that's the descendants of somebody 20 generations up. And it's pretty clear that's not entirely true, but that's at least the theory of it. So when you say my elders, it's one of the things that confused me when I was reading Van Noten, and I thought got cleared up when I was reading Lewis, is that Van Noten writes as if the Gifo-paying group and the Dia-paying group are fixed sizes, like one of them is three generations and one of them four or something, I don't remember exactly. It's pretty clear that from Lewis's standpoint, rather, in a particular situation, the Dia-paying group is the coalition that's dealing with that. But a year later, it might be that a subpart set of that is fighting another subset of that or is looting a set of that. So that really, these are not fixed numbers of generations, but one is the subset of the other. It's really what the function is they're portraying. So my guess is, though I'm not sure, that who the relevant elders are is going to depend a lot on the conflict. That if I'm quarreling with somebody who's got a common great-grandfather, then maybe that great-grandfather had two sons. Well, I'm descended from one channel. He's descended from the other. So maybe it's the elder of the descendants of this son versus the elder of the descendants of that one. They get together and they court. But I'm not sure that's right. But it's something like that. And that's sort of part of what's intriguing about it, is this whole system. And there's the line that I think Lewis quotes, one of them quotes, that of somebody talking to a European and saying, what your address is in Europe, your genealogy is in Somalia. And that's sort of a perceptive way of putting it, because, you know, in Europe, what are you? Well, you're a citizen of San Jose. Well, you're a citizen of Santa Clara County. Well, you're a citizen of California. We're a citizen of the U.S. And you sort of, in different contexts, you would see it as different ones of those things. That, you know, if you are unhappy with California income tax, you might think about moving out of the state. If you're unhappy with U.S. income tax, you'd have to move out of the country, harder to do, and so forth. And similarly with regard to the city. We, nowadays, my wife's preference is to buy her groceries in Santa Clara rather than in, I think it's Santa Clara rather than San Jose, because San Jose has a rule against giving you out grocery bags, and Santa Clara does not yet have that rule, and although the amounts involved are trivial, she resents the idea that someone else is telling her in the grocery store what interactions they can have with each other. So at that level, you're choosing among local governments even, and you do get some of that. And I think it's, you know, in the U.S. you get cigarette smuggling across state boundaries, as you may know, when one state has a much higher cigarette tax than the other. One of the costs of raising your cigarette tax is you sell cigarettes, not just because people don't smoke, but because they smuggle it in from the next state over. So in that sense, I mean, it's a different way of thinking, as it were, and it's less geographical. And I'm sure there's some geographical correlation. You've got some tendency to live close to your relatives, but you don't have to.
Yeah. So it seems also like all the wealth among either the Jaffe-paying group or the Dia-paying group, whatever level it's at, it seems like all the wealth is basically shared.
No, that's an overstatement, not the wealth. What's getting shared is the income from damage payments, essentially. And that's being shared not equally, but by some kind of a formula. So that if you look at the actual contract I give at the end, which is sort of an interesting one, it looks as though what's happening is that if somebody injures me, and they agree to pay damages, if the damage level isn't too high, then I think all of it goes to me and my immediate relatives. And if they've killed me, or maybe they've done something serious enough to get a Wehrgeld level, as it were, punishment, now a big chunk of it goes to us, but then some of the rest is spread among the rest of the group. And of course, since the rest of the group are the people who are responsible for making sure we get that damage payment, I'd be willing to fight for it if necessary. That makes a certain amount of sense.
Okay, well, what I'm basically saying is that the arbitrators are not neutral. I mean, like, they have skin in the game, right?
Except that you've got arbitrators from both sides. That is the system, if I understand it correctly, it sounds as though you're picking arbitrators from my clan and, or not clan, from my kin group and your kin group. And I presume that when we're appealing it up, then I'm guessing that what that means is that the first round, it was the most prominent descendant of my great grandfather versus the most prominent descendant of your great grandfather got together to agree what was to be done. And the second round, they're calling in the most prominent descendant of all of our great great grandfather, and maybe. But I'm not sure. That is, it's not like I have spent a lifetime studying this. That's what seems to be going on. But notice also that having skin in the game is a little tricky, because remember that if you don't get accepted settlements, you end up fighting each other, and then that could hurt your skin too. So that all of this, if I understand it, is backstopped by feud. So that what's going on is that we, just as if you look in the Icelandic case, the extreme situation is self-judgment, is when somebody says the plaintiff can be the arbitrator. And there he's relying on the plaintiff wanting the reputation of being an honorable and generous person. And it's also reflecting the fact that he's lost. He knows the other guy's got much more access to force than he does, and he's not going to do very well if he ends up in a feud. You see that pattern happening sometimes. I think one does have to sort of see it again as this overlay of some court mechanism and the potential of feud. Just as in the Icelandic case, I think it's reasonably clear that if you're too clever about gaming the legal system, if you figure out some really clever way of winning a case you should have lost, the other side says, well, that's all right, we'll kill you, and now your side will pay us somewhere to go, and we'll pay you somewhere to go, and we're all clear. And you get various things sort of related to that. You get cases where sometimes arbitration breaks down, sometimes the court case breaks down, sometimes it doesn't. But everybody is sort of doing it in the context where eventually things are going to go the way the rules say they do, and therefore you've got to play within the shadow, as it were, of those outcomes. And I assume that's true here, too. And I think I mentioned one of the cases that Lewis cites under the British, I think when the British were still theoretically in charge, where for some reason two clans get into an extended feud, and the leadership of both sides decides we're getting too many of our people killed, so they jointly agree to raise the weregeld. They agree that the penalty for killing, the law for killing people is going to be higher than it used to be. Greater incentive to avoid killing people. I don't know if I mentioned in the Icelandic case, I read a piece by somebody on the rules for home gang. Home gang was judicial duel. And I think there was more than one version. But there's at least one version of home gang where we've got a legal dispute, and they spread out a cloak on the ground and then put up a barrier like 3 feet beyond the edge of the cloak. So it's an enclosed, not very large space. And we're fighting inside of that. And the fight ends when the first drop of blood hits the cloak. And the person who has been wounded loses the case unless he dies, in which case he wins the case. Right? Think about that as an incentive system. It means that I, fighting you, want to wound you, but want to make sure I don't wound you lethally. Because what's important is not, for me, is not whether you're alive. It's whether I get the land we're arguing over, that we're disagreeing over. So, I can't resist, though it's a digression, with regard to home gang. There's one of these judicial duels, I think not under those rules, in Egil's saga, which is interesting, because what happens is Egil is in Norway for some reason, and he's visiting the sister of Arinbjorn, who is his close friend. Who later gets involved in the business at York that I think I may have described at one point. And the sister is very upset, and he asks her why, and he eventually finds out that what's happening is there's a berserker, somebody who sort of goes crazy in battle, who has claimed their land and is insisting on trial by combat. And Arinbjorn is nowhere around, so the only male available to fight it is her, like, 16-year-old son. And so Egil says, I'll take care of this. And Egil challenges the berserker, and they fight. And Egil strikes the berserker with his sword, but the berserker won't bleed. It's somehow, you know, I don't know if you believe it, if he's supposed to be magic or, you know, hysterical, something or other. And eventually Egil gets tired of this nonsense, and he throws down his sword, he throws down his shield, he throws down the berserker, and he bites his throat out. And you sort of have the feeling that Egil is the real thing that the berserker is sort of half an imitation of, which means the berserker really shouldn't have fought him. And that goes along with things like the line about, you know, if he's a man, he looks more like a troll to me. That Egil, his father and his grandfather, feel not quite human in an odd kind of way. I mean, they're ugly, they're big, they're strong, they're ferocious. They're not very nice people. I mean, they're not wicked people, but I think Egil does his first killing at 10 or 11 or something like that. another boy in some kind of a conflict. So it's a very interesting picture. That's part of the reason I think I like Egilsaga better than some of the others, is that it has this not quite fantasy feeling. It's all believable and real. There is a little bit of magic, but you never know how real it is. That Egil at one point sets up a horse's head on a pole on an island outside of Norway and speaks word over it that Erik Bloodaxe, who is the son of the king who his family's been feuding with, will never know peace in Norway again. And the next time you see Erik, considerably later in the saga, he's been driven out of Norway by his brothers and is ruling northern England underneath the King of England. So it's not like the saga tells you the magic works, but that's sort of the implication. And similarly, Egil's grandfather, they say he worked very hard during the day, but he went always early to sleep, and people said he was a strong shape changer. And his name is Kveldulf, which means evening wolf. So again, they're not telling you that he's a werewolf. And the Icelandic shape changers aren't our picture of werewolf. As far as I can tell, the idea is that somebody was asleep, his consciousness goes out in animal form while his body is there. But it's sort of hinting at it. And then I think I mentioned the line later on when Egil is at York, when there is a bird pecking at the window, keeping him from composing a poem, and Arin Bjorn sees a shape changer go by. It's like, yeah, the pretty clear implication. But that's part of the fun. I mean, they feel much subtler than modern fantasy fiction, as it were. As though you can believe in the whole story without believing in the magic, but, you know, they sort of believe in the magic. Though you do get ghosts sometimes pretty explicitly. There's a wonderful section in one of the sagas where a ghost is making a whole lot of trouble, and so they eventually use legal procedures to deal with him. They basically summon him by the appropriate legal formula, go through it, and by God, he's an Icelandic ghost, and when the law goes against him, he goes away, it's not fine. I can't quote you to exactly, but it's a great passage. Let me go back to sort of comments about it. Oh yes, one of the quotes in there is, between religion and tradition, choose tradition. So outside of the special areas. And what that reminds me of is a bit in the Icelandic history, which is that there's some point after Iceland goes Christian, when I guess the bishops are telling the Icelanders, the Pope has said, you've got to do something, or what it is, maybe give the bishops more authority or something. And one of the Icelandic leaders says, I don't see why the opinion of some priest in Rome should overrule the custom of our fathers. And is quite unwilling to go along with what they say. Which is also interesting, because we sort of, I think, exaggerate the uniformity of medieval Europe in terms of religious authority. There's an interesting point that's made in a book on different contexts, but a book about really about 12th century England, roughly, which is that almost all of our sources on the Middle Ages are written by clergymen. And consequently, we get a very biased picture of that society. And the particular book, which is about William Marshall, who was a very prominent English knight, was, among other things, regent of England after John died, is, and the book is largely about his deathbed scene. And certainly William is a believing Catholic. He went on crusade. He was a member of the Templars. But when he's dying and the priest, and he says, oh, I just realized I forgot to allocate all of my rich garments in setting up a will. And the priest says, well, you know, you could sell them for money and use the money to pay for prayers for your soul. And he says, no, nonsense. This is the time of year when I give gifts to the young men of my household, my squires and such. And so what I'll do is to allocate my rich garments among them. And at a different point, the priest says to William, you know, in order to go to heaven or something, anything you've taken for anybody, you ought to give back. And William says, don't be silly. I've, you know, won 43 tournaments. I've taken all sorts of horses and gear from people in those tournaments. No way am I giving that back. So you have the general impression of somebody who believes in the religion, but doesn't take the priest's opinion of anything any more serious than anybody else's opinion. So the point that this is a French, modern French medieval historian who's writing the book, and his argument is that the nice thing about William is that our source for him is a verse biography commissioned by his friends and relatives after his death. And that's produced from inside the chivalric class, not from the priestly class, and therefore gives the view of his life as seen by other knights, not the view of his life as seen by the clergy. So that's sort of it. It's a digression, but it's sort of an interesting one because it's relevant to a lot of the stuff we're talking about, I think. let me go go back. So you've got the contrast between the Icelandic and the Somali case of, on the one hand, a fixed court system, although the judges are amateurs. That is, the court system has a mechanism for choosing judges, a fixed mechanism, namely the Gothar, the so-called chieftains. Each of them gets to pick a judge, at least at a high-level court, but the judges themselves are not. Versus the Somali system, which is sort of less organized, more informal, but there are people who are going to have the job of selecting the judge to agree on, and then the judge or judges decide the case. I'm not sure, it's just sort of unclear between my sources to what extent it's the elders themselves who are judging it and to what extent it's that they're agreeing on the person who will judge, because the Dutch lawyer makes it sound as though each case you've got a judge who's been selected and agreed upon by the parties, by Naughton, whereas Lewis makes it sound more as though it's the elders who are judging, and I'm not sure which is right, and I should probably go back and reread Lewis to see if I can figure that out. The structure in the Icelandic case, if you're in a feud, you're probably not in it all by yourself, but you're in it with either current or ad hoc allies. That is, either your best friend or your adult sons or people like that, or you have scenes where people are collecting allies. There's a scene in Njalsaga which is really quite interesting and which I think I understand, but I may be wrong, because this is a scene where the Njalssons are going around at the Althing visiting various people to try to persuade them to support them in a lawsuit, which is going to become a feud eventually. And the thing is that each of the people they go to, Scarphaven, who is one of the Njalssons and is a very dangerous fighter, but also sort of not entirely, I'm not sure he's crazy, but he feels dangerous. He feels like a psychopathic killer or something of the sort, a little bit in the area of that. And each time they're starting to persuade somebody, and then Scarphaven insults them. And you think, what's going on? You know, is it just these nuts? But then the final one is Guzman the powerful, or Guzman the rich, who's the most important of the people. And they're talking about him, and the particular person, they're trying to get allies against somebody called Bully Thorkel. And, yes, that's right. No, I'm wrong. Bully Thorkel is one of the people just before Guzman. And Bully Thorkel, and Scarphaven is rude to Bully Thorkel, and Bully Thorkel sort of stands up and says, you know, I'm going to pull out my sword, and, you know, this is my sword, and Scarphaven says, yeah, and this is my axe with which I killed three men sliding across the ice, sits down, and Bully Thorkel sits down. Guzman, what Scarphaven does is to remind Guzman of how he was mistreated by Bully Thorkel. So what is actually going on, I think, and then Guzman joins them. And he's the important one. So what's going on is that if Scarphaven said to Guzman, look, I'll get your revenge on Bully Thorkel by shaming him, because I can bluff him down, because I'm a more dangerous man than he is. That doesn't sound right. That's sort of buying your support. But he's got the excuse to doing it, being rude to everybody. And he is now, in effect. So anyway, I may be wrong, but it's sort of an interesting example of the way in which the sagas don't explain things. They just show you things, and you've got to figure out for yourself what's going on. It reminds me, I don't know if any of you remember an old television program called Mission Impossible. People still remember that one? You remember that one. Because the form of that was that this team of sort of special people have some project, some, you know, foreign, whatever, you know, adventure kind of thing. And you're told what the project is, but you're never told how they're going to do it. And then the show, you're watching it happening and gradually figuring out why they're doing the various odd things they're doing. So it really is almost as if they'd been learning from the Icelandic sagas how to tell a story, which I thought was also rather neat. In any case, so the pattern of dividing the payment and the response, as I say, the Icelandic case, as far as you can tell, payment is in principle by the individual and maybe his immediate relatives. But sometimes he's helped by his allies, so that when you're getting one of these settlements, I'll chip in this much. And in a way, the Icelandic system is formal with the court system and informal with the alliances. And the Somali system is informal with the court system and formal with the alliances. So the Somali, you've got a written contract saying who agrees to pay how much. Icelandic one, you don't. at the same time, the Islamic law, I don't remember if I discussed it, but there is something, it's not clear how much it was really, how real it was at the point of the law we're looking at. But in principle, there's a diya paying group in Islamic law. So that in principle, when you owe damages for killing or injuring somebody, there is some set of people related to you who are supposed to share in it. And in fact, diya is coming. What's going on, I think, is that the British who were running northern Somalia had also been running Egypt and India, where they were dealing with lots of Muslims, and therefore the term diya is not actually the Somali term for it, it's the Arabic term for it, which they were imposing in describing it. But the diya-paying group in Islamic law, it sounds though it was originally your tribe. And the people writing about the modern people writing about Islamic law are unsure to what extent it was really the case you were sharing this and what it wasn't. But that they were in principle, it was things like the common members of your profession in a town were sort of your synthetic tribe, as it were. And it all seems rather unclear, but at least in principle, the Islamic law codes are assuming that there's some pre-existing group who have some responsibility. Now, they don't really have responsibility for feud, at least in theory, although for all I know, there may have been real feuds still happening, you know, even though it wasn't supposed to in terms of the Islamic law. But furthermore, if you look at Irish law, which we'll be doing in a little while, you get there a very similar pattern where you have a kin group. Again, most of these groups are defined by agnatic succession, which means male line. And so in the Irish case, you've got groups, and at different times it seems to have varied exactly how many generations up it went, but it's something like the descendants of a common great-grandfather. And in the Irish case, and to some extent in the Somali case, they own land in common. So that in the Irish case, some of the land belongs to your kin group and is allocated at any given time among the families of the kin group. But you don't get to sell that land without the permission of the other members of the kin group. And there seems to be some process, I think, of reallocation after the generation. So it's not entirely yours. There's other land that you've acquired in other ways, which is really yours. And one of the things we'll be discussing when we get to the Irish, which is quite interesting, is that you have quite elaborate contractual law where, to some extent, what contracts you can make is limited by the fact that other people have an interest in it. So that I can't, if I make a contract that could cost kinland under some circumstances, I need the explicit permission of my kin to do it. If I make a contract which could result in my owning damages which my kin were liable for, then in some contexts, if the kin don't say anything, they're liable for it. But the kin have the option not of canceling the contract, but of pulling out of it, of saying, we won't be responsible for this. So you've again got this sort of fairly complicated situation where you've got kinship relationships. It's not just kin, it's husband-wife, too. We'll be getting at this to the Irish as well. But in the husband-wife situation, you have a bunch of different categories of marriage. And presumably the most common one is marriage on man's property, which means that most of the common property of the couple belongs to the man. And in that context, the husband has a pretty much unlimited power of canceling his wife's contracts, and the wife a very limited power of canceling certain subsets of her husband's contracts that affect the household. But you also have marriage on woman's property. If you have a couple where the woman brought most of the property, now it reverses exactly. And you've got marriage on joint property where each one has symmetrically somewhat similar abilities to cancel contracts. And you have father-son relationships of that sort, that the son is ultimately going to be responsible for supporting the father. So therefore, if the son is entering into a contract which might prevent him from supporting the father may be able to cancel it. And I think there are even situations where the son can cancel the father's contract. I'd have to go into that in more detail. But again, it's really quite interesting because it's on the one hand an elaborate private law system for making and enforcing contracts, but then a bunch of restrictions because of the fact that it's not like each person is an island. Each person is part of a web of mutual obligations and interactions. And of course, it isn't just here. Let's go back to the Jewish law. I think I discussed the whole issue of what happens in Jewish law if you have a prior claim to my property if I don't pay my debt, and then I sell the property to him. All right, so it's the same kind of issue. My ability to sell the property to him is in fact restricted by the fact that that's the property that's backing up my your loan to me. And I guess that's interesting. I don't know. I guess the same thing we threw in our system, right? If I haven't paid off the loan on my car and I sell it to you, the loan goes with the car, right? So it's not the same one. It's in the Irish one, it's really a question of whether A can cancel B's contracts, whether A can say, without my permission, you're not allowed to make that contract, or to what extent they can. So anyway, yes.
Do you have to cancel before there's some actual liability?
There are circumstances in which canceling itself, you then owe a small fine to the other party of the contract. And I think in the question of whether or not you're liable if he defaults, I think the assumption is that if a representative of the kinship group is present when the contract is made, then his not saying anything means that he's going to be liable, that you're taking it for granted. But I'm not sure about other cases to what extent you have to have positive approval as opposed to not having disapproval. Presumably a lot of this is happening in small enough communities so that everybody knows what everybody else is doing, and therefore the issue isn't going to arise. Anyway, going back to the Somali. So the Somali, by the account we've got, mostly they don't own land because they're mostly cattle herders, but some of them do. There are settled communities as well, and there the land, again, is sometimes joint property of a kinship group, shared with, I presume at any given time, certain people having rights with regard to it, and then can only be used by the kinship group, or at least people have some ties, if somebody who's married to somebody in the kinship group, Van Noten basically gets into the whole society by marrying a Somali wife. How he met her, I have no idea. I'd be interested to know his actual biography. It's sort of odd for a Dutch lawyer to end up married to a woman from the Horn of Africa, but obviously he did. Another point which we'll come to again in the Irish case, which sort of struck me as odd, is that Irish law and Somali law both have what the Irish call sick maintenance. And sick maintenance is a rule which seems to have been going out of practice by the time the law code is written down, but it still gets mentioned, which basically says that when I injure you, aside from other obligations, I've got to put you up as my guest. And I've got to make sure the house is quiet. We can't have kids playing in where you are and bothering you. And if you're a really important person, I have to not only put up you, but the set of retainers you're allowed to have with you. And I'm feeding those people, and I'm providing medical services for you and all of this until you get well. And I don't know about the retainers, but Somali law apparently also has the rule that part of the obligation when I've injured you is to host you while getting you well, which I again thought was interesting. A little bit worrisome, because you'd say, you know, well, if I really injured you because I didn't like you, maybe I'll poison you while you're in my house. But, yeah, no, just stretching. Right. I don't think there is anything quite analogous to the Icelandic outlawry that I can see in the Somali system, but the closest thing to that is kicking you out of the dia-paying group, essentially. That is the closest thing to that, which is really a little bit like the Irish thing about saying, we won't, for this contract, we won't be liable. If he doesn't fulfill it. So that what's happening apparently in the Somali group is that, you know, you've killed three people, we've had to pay off the dia for three people. It's a lot of money. We're not very happy with this. You're no longer part of our group. Goodbye. We will tell everybody we won't pay your debts. We won't help you in your feud. You've now got a real problem because not only are you going to have to pay all the money to kill a fourth person, but if somebody comes after you, there's going to be nobody who's going to force them to pay damages afterwards. So presumably, that's going to be the closest thing to outlawry. Now, maybe you can find another group that'll have you. You could certainly imagine, you suppose you're a very formidable warrior, and you know, you get into a lot of quarrels, but you're also a useful guy to have on. I mean, that's Skarphedin in the Egil saga. Not Egil saga, Njal saga, different saga. Yeah, Skarphedin never runs into Egil, as far as I know. And I think Egil wins, is my guess. But One of the other things I thought was neat, looking again at sort of comparing different systems, is that like the Amish, the Somali have real social contracts. All right, the Amish, your group is your congregation, and you are obliged to that congregation's rules when you've sworn to accept it. The Somali, your group is your diapaying group, and you are bound to its rules, which include things like if somebody else within your group kills you, how much damage do they owe to your relatives, or injures you, or whatever. Or how will we settle disputes within the group, but that's an explicit contract that you've joined into. So again, that was sort of interesting. You know, we talk about social contracts, but some of these designs actually have them, for real. So let me go back to the agnatic kinship system, which is also sort of interesting, because on the one hand, each Somali believes he knows his ancestry up for something like 20 generations. But it sounds from Lewis's research as though it isn't really true, as though these chains of ancestors have gotten edited over time. And you can tell because if you've got a bunch of different people, you can see whether they're consistent. Or you've got people who at some point their chains join. And the pattern seems to be from what Lewis, I'm pretty sure this is what Lewis's comment was, that links where there's no division tend to drop out. So you've got somebody here who has two sons, and he has one son, and he has two sons. These two people can get, this guy doesn't matter. Because being descended from him and being descended from him have exactly the same implication who your allies are. So this, by the time you're finished, this line may have one more link in it than that one, even though they got to have the same number of links, if that makes sense. And furthermore, the very top of the hierarchy is likely to be mythical, or at least is suspected to be mythical. Because part of what's going on is clans trying to claim prestige by being connected to prominent figures in Islamic history. All right, Somalia is fairly close to Arabia with some water in between them. And there are therefore these various stories, some of which might be true, but I don't think, at least Lewis seems to think that a lot of them probably aren't, in which some prominent Muslim gets shipwrecked or something in Somali, is adopted by a Somali clan, becomes the ancestor of a whole line, and therefore the members of this clan can say, look, we're important people, we're descended from so-and-so who was a companion of the prophet, or something of that sort. So at least it sounds as though probably at the very top of the clan genealogy, some of it's probably fictional. And in between, it's not fictional, but parts of it have been edited out because they're really irrelevant. Because the important question is who are your potential allies? And any time that a father has only one son, that's adding no information to that system. All right? So
with the Amish, it seems like you don't enter into the contract until you come of age and choose to be baptized. With the Somali, at least from the reading, it's not exactly clear how much of a choice you really have when entering.
Yes. Well, the sense in which you have a choice is that the diapaying group is not fully defined by kinship. So the diapaying group that you've got sort of lumps inside it, which are the common descendants of a common grandfather in the Agnatic line, but there may be several such groups not closely related which choose to ally with each other. And presumably, in principle, you could say, well, it's true, you and I, you're my brother, so we're very closely related by the same father, by agnatic kinship, but I really don't get along with you very well, and since all the people in the coalition you're part of are friends of yours, I'm going to drop out and see if I can find somebody through my mother's brother, for example. But it sounds as though, although the first priority, as it were, is you ally with agnatic kin. The second is uterine kin, through your mother's kin. And in particular, your mother's brother is considered to be a particularly close relative for some reason, your uncle on that side. And then the third priority is just unrelated people who choose to be together. So you've got this phrase, a pile of shields, which means what ought to be a kinship-based coalition, but that has no kinship basis to it. It's just, we've got to pile up enough shields so that we're in a fight we can defend ourselves. And that's apparently the term used for things such as the U.S. alliance against the Soviets, which again I thought was really cute that we're used to seeing them in our terms, but of course they are seeing us in their terms, naturally enough. I'm just thinking whether we've got other interesting examples of that. And of course, with the Amish, you've got the Amish view of us. We're the English from their standpoint because we speak English. But the Amish view of us seems to me an awful lot like the view of us by a lot of non-Amish critics of modern society. We're all too materialist and divorcing our job from our life and status seeking and stuff like that, all of which has some truth to it. But the so what's going on with these? Systems is that if this guy gets into a conflict where he needs four people to make a reasonable alliance, the natural group will be this group. And it might be the conflict is with somebody over here who's got them. So it might be this group versus this group, say. But then something comes up where they're opposing a much stronger and larger coalition, so now these two groups fuse, and it becomes all of this group is one coalition. But there may also, as I say, since it's contract as well as kinship, it might be that your coalition also includes, you know, something coming down by another line might also be in there. All right? And I think it sounds as though within the De Dea paying group, the smaller lumps are more likely to be kinship, I think. But I don't think there's any level which it has to be. And the numbers, by the way, that Lewis gives, he suggests that the Dea paying group is typically between about 300 and 3,000 males. That's who was doing the fighting, and that's sort of and that's apparently enough. And the constraint, the reason you want at least 300, there are really two objectives pushing the number up. One of them is if there is a fight, you want enough people to have a reasonable chance of winning. And one of them is if you end up having to pay damages, you want to have enough people to share the damages so it's not too heavy a burden on anybody. And the limit the other way is really internal politics. The limit the other way is if you have too big a group, it's too likely that me and my relatives don't like you and your relatives, and look, we had to pay money because you got us into a fight 3 years ago, and besides, I want to be an important guy, and your father is higher status than I am, so I'd rather not be in the same group he's in, because then I won't be the leader, and you know, big fish, small pond kind of phenomenon. So it sounds like you've got a tension between those two things, which give you about a one factor of 10 range of sizes for these groups. And the groups can reform, of course. That is, you can split, 100 go this way, 200 go that way, and then they find some other allies to make a new group if they want to. So all of that struck me sort of interesting in trying to look at how that system worked. And, you know, in one sense, you're tempted to say, well, these are really governments, except that they don't feel very much like governments, but they're doing some of the work of governments. What are the factors that give you stability? By Van Noten's account, the usual obligation to members of your group is to help defend but not to help attack. You may choose to help attack. Now, I'd have to look at the contracts more than I have to see whether sometimes you were agreeing to help attack. But at least the default rule, I think, is that you're agnatic kin and your members of your groups have to help you to defend. Second, there's the case I mentioned for stability that when people are unhappy at too much killing, they raise the Wehrgeld, at least in one case. And third, there's the business that if it's too uneven, you can pull in more people and expand your coalition up and thus. Other things in contrasting it to Sharia, the rule in general is three witnesses, whereas in fiqh, in Islamic law, it's either two or four, depending on the particular part of it. It's four for illicit sex and two for most other things, if I've got it right. Penalty in camels, though not the identical schedule. If I've got it correctly, the Somali rule for intentional killing seems to be a life for a life. Two lives for a life if it's from a different clan. The Sikh rule for killing, for intentional killing, or first-degree murder, is the kin can insist on a life for a life, but don't have to. And it sounded as though the Sikh rule was that you only get to kill the guy who did it. I'm not sure if that's explicitly in the rule, but that's what the descriptions all sound like. Whereas the Somali view rule seems to be, well, you really ought to kill the guy who did it, but if you ain't going to get him, you can get somebody else from his kin group. And furthermore, that if they let him escape, then you're entitled legally to kill, I think, two people from his group, if I've got it correctly, which is an incentive not. Maybe it was one, I don't know, I get confused between the out-clan and in-clan. The clans are big. The clans are hundreds of thousands of people. So most disputes are going to be within a clan. But sometimes they'll be across clans, and I think only rarely are they between clans, that normally things aren't happening at that high a level up. But it was also interesting that their distinction, in a sense, their crime-tort distinction, but it's on the criterion of intention, not who enforces it, seems to be that intentional offenses double the penalty. That if you steal something, you owe twice the amount back, or you just accidentally, you know, I was shooting in that direction, I happened to kill your camel, I owe you a camel. Similarly, if I've got it correctly, and if I intentionally kill you, I owe a life, whereas if I unintentionally kill you, I only owe damages. Seems to be right. Also interesting that, like a number of these systems, oaths are a part of the legal system. I mentioned that in Jewish law, that at least according to one of the accounts I saw, even if the plaintiff in a case can't prove his case, the defendant has to swear he's innocent before he gets acquitted. And there are cases where you don't have enough witnesses to prove something and where you use oaths instead. And one of the things I sort of liked was the oath containing its own penalty. So if you swear by your marriage, if it turns out later that it was false, you're divorced. Which I thought was sort of a neat trick in that. You get stuff a little bit like that, at least in medieval Islamic stories I've seen, where people swear, if such and such doesn't happen, I'm divorced from my wife. But I think that's not swearing to facts. That's like, there's one story where have I told you the story of how to weigh an elephant? An elephant arrives at the port. They've never seen an elephant before. Big animal on a ship. Bring it off the ship. One of the bystanders says, I wonder what that thing weighs. I am divorced from my wife if nobody can find out what it weighs. Well, his neighbors don't want him to divorce her. His wife says, I'm trying to figure out how do you weigh an elephant? And they can't figure out. There's no scale building big enough to do it. And so finally they go to Hizrat Ali. Ali was the fourth caliph, but it was probably before that. Ali is a very wise man. Let's ask him. And Ali says, here's how you weigh an elephant. You put the elephant back in the ship, and you mark on the hull of the ship how high up the water comes. You then take the elephant out and load the ship up with weights until the water comes to the same height. You then weigh the weights one at a time on the scales, but you can do it, add it up, and you've got the weight of the elephant. Perfectly good answer. But what interested me was sort of the context of you've got to do it because he's made this oath. And there are a variety of Harun al-Rashid stories where somebody gets into trouble by swearing an oath to do something, and then the clever judge has got to figure out some legal trick to get him out of it. So it's a weird kind of pattern, but it does look as though somehow there are commitment strategies, as it were, which can be useful, right? If you think about, I swear that if you kill my friend, I'll kill you, that could be a very useful thing to have done, and having a society where I then felt obliged to do it. Suppose I say, if you kill my friend and I don't kill you, I'm divorced from my wife. Well, that's a commitment strategy if it really works. So it's sort of an interesting feature of some of those systems that it seems to be working that way. Do we use oaths? And do we think they really have any effect?
Well, we swear to tell the truth.
That's right. We swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Yeah.
Well, whether or not they have an effect, they do have a kind of a significance, because we will hold you accountable for
that's right.
Or failing an oath of office. So it seems more just and more fair to at least give someone proper notice that they will be held to account.
Yes. That is, in particular, the perjury case is one in which the oath has a real legal consequence. Now, it only has that consequence if we choose to enforce it, which is, but in principle, it has a legal consequence. Does anybody know? I was wondering, actually, in some of these cases, is it actually perjury if you tell the truth but not the whole truth?
Oh, you mean like an error by omission?
No, a deliberate one. Suppose you ask me, who did you see at the crime scene? And I said, I saw Bill and I saw John. But I'm not mentioning I also saw Mary.
It depends on what the question is and the specific, like, that's how, who was it, the guy that examined Clinton? He asked the question in a very particular way to leave him an out, potentially. Mm. So that's what undid the whole charge against him.
Mm.
It depends on how the question is asked. But if it's one of those where it's inescapable and they should answer and they don't and they leave out material facts, then yes.
The case I've been wondering about, just from fairly recent news stories, is that apparently the DEA had access to what was essentially a pen register of the entire country. That is, that the phone companies were giving them the complete information, not of what you said, but of who called whom when.
Right.
And the DEA was instructing its people when testifying in court to conceal this fact. Probably because they just didn't want people to know, because then people would be more careful about who they call.
Oh, yeah, it's not even completed, it's what you dial.
So the question then is, does that mean that the DEA agents would be instructed to engage in perjury on the grounds? Now, presumably, I assume if they were careful, at least they never said anything that was untrue. They gave the impression that they had found out this in some way, but if they are deliberately omitting material facts... The case I was wondering about, and I've been asking, I haven't gotten a really sufficiently clear answer, is suppose it is at least arguable that that pen register was illegal. I'm not sure it is. Pen registers, we don't know. We know that a pen register in general doesn't require a warrant, but whether having a pen register on the entire country, including people most of whom you have no reason doing anything illegal, is legal, I think is a question that hasn't been litigated. Suppose you think that there's an argument that it is legal. Can you, as the defense counsel of somebody who was convicted, go back to the court and say the prosecution failed their obligation to give us the relevant information? Because if they had told us that was how they got that information, we would have objected that the fruit of the tree should be excluded, and they couldn't use anything they learned as a result of that information. I don't know. That just struck me as an interesting case. There was, as you may know, there was a case fairly recently in Massachusetts where it turned out that there was somebody who was doing chemical analyses of drugs who had been faking it, and they had to throw out or retry a whole lot of cases. And I was just wondering if this was a case where sort of everything the DEA did could be questioned. And my guess is the answer is not, but it's at least interesting to think about as a hypothetical. So let's see. What else can one interestingly say? And the answer is I don't know. It would be nice. Yeah?
So earlier I was saying that the wealth is shared, but I just found a passage that I was wrong.
This is the rich kinsman?
Yeah, so apparently if you're wealthy, if you're a wealthy man,
it's not as complete as saying that everything is held in common. But you know, that did interest me and seemed to me a little bit odd, because obviously it's an incentive not to become a wealthy person. But again, I don't know if we know enough to really understand what's going on in all of these things. Whether, for example, the people you've shared it with then have obligations to you in the future. Maybe they do, maybe they don't.
Well, they have obligations to help you pay your. If you ever get in a lawsuit with someone else.
That would be one thing. And they have an obligation, because only if they're wealthy and you're poor in the future. So that you can think of some of these things as sort of insurance, implicit insurance policies. But, again, I don't know enough. I mean, that's all of these things, you know. I know a bunch, but there's a whole bunch more I don't. And some of it nobody knows, probably. Or maybe people in Somalia know. Note, by the way, that if you take a taxi cab in San Jose, there's a significant chance that your driver will be Somali. One of mine was from Puntland and was surprised they knew where Puntland was. But they're probably going to be young enough and far enough out of Somalia, so they probably can't answer the questions we'd like to have answered. Let me see if there are other things that struck me worth talking about, because I think I have at this point pretty much run out of my list of things that I thought were worth talking about Somalia. So I think it is up to you if you have things either about Somalia or about... Yes?
To go back to your kind of statement that maternal uncles have a more special relationship, it might be because genetics, or not genetics, but you know that there's an ethical relationship.
That's right. That is there is the old argument that maternal kinship is more confident than paternal kinship, because it is a wise man that knows his father. A wise child that knows his father is the old phrase. And I've been arguing in various contexts that that's something which has very recently changed. That I've been, in my book Future Imperfect, I identify paternity testing as the stealth genetic technology. All right? Everybody talks about cloning and stuff and genetic engineering. But paternity testing is here. It's a reliable technology. It's sort of off the shelf. It's not very expensive. But that means that one of the central facts of human society since we've been a species has just been abolished. The fact that the fact of who somebody's mother is known because she came out of her body. And the fact of who somebody's father is inferred from trusting the mother, or from the fact that you watched your wife and made sure she had no opportunity to have sex with anybody else, or maybe the fact that he looks sort of like you. But if you think about human mating institutions, I think one of the central features of most human societies is that men want exclusive sexual access to their wives, which is one of the reasons why polyandry is much less common than polygyny. All right, polygamy is both. Polyandry is multiple husbands. Polygyny is multiple wives. Polyandry exists in some societies, but it's fairly uncommon. Monogamy is the most common pattern, but polygyny is the second most common. Well, both monogamy and polygyny have the characteristic that if you can enforce it, which is always the issue, you know who your children are. And there's clearly a strong evolutionary pressure to know who your children are, because otherwise you end up spending your resources on somebody else's children and then your genes die out. You know, this is the cuckoo story, basically. Cuckoos are supposed to successfully lay their eggs in other birds' nests. And that's, you know, the whole issue of being a couple, which is coming out of cuckoo, is something that lots of different societies, you know, you see stories in lots of different societies where one of the issues is, did your wife betray you or not? So, we were just talking in my other class about Lord Mansfield, because he played an important role in a very early copyright issue. But Lord Mansfield is also the source of Lord Mansfield's rule, which is the rule that says that a husband cannot legally contest the paternity of his wife's child conceived at a time when they were cohabiting, which was a sensible rule until now, but it no longer is a sensible rule because we now have ways of actually testing it. Before that, we didn't. But one of the things I've wondered about is whether paternity testing will ultimately result in changes in mating patterns. Because you could now imagine a group family where you've got more than one, both male and female, who are having sex with each other, but where if a child arrives, you know who the father was. So if what's driving the standard pattern is men wanting to know the identity of their children, then it's no longer true. If what's going on is that we've evolved male sexual jealousy, whether or not there's a reason for it, then you're going to still have the same pattern. All right, make sense? I find at least trying. We're moving into a very interesting future, and I think that most people badly underestimate the uncertainty of the future. That is to say that most people assume that the next decade will be like this decade. That's why sort of one of the reasons for my skepticism on the whole global warming account, quite aside from everything else, is that when you're projecting 100 years into the future, you just don't know what's going to happen. That, you know, 100 years from now, we could have wiped ourselves out in any of three or four different ways. 100 years from now, we could have made so much progress that you can solve global warming with the pocket change of your random multi-billionaire. Or it could be, you know, I don't know. And therefore, but it seems to me that predictions, Future Imperfect, I mostly limit myself to 30 years.
the book I've got, you can read it if you like, somewhere on my webpage to be read for free. And basically the rule of thumb I used there was that I wasn't willing to try to make any predictions more than 30 years out. And the only exception was space, because if you're going to talk about the future, if you've read science fiction, you've got to talk about space. And probably nothing much is going to be happening in space as soon as 30 years out. But other than that, I try to stick to that. All right, I think we've run out of things to talk about. It's 5 minutes early, and I will cheat you out of 5 minutes of my time because you aren't sufficiently aggressive to ask questions that would consume that 5 minutes.